If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
So I also find it really reassuring when I get their underwriting back and it's around where mine is, right? So on the expense side, that's something that you can do to make sure that you're not, underestimating the expenses on the property.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Jonathan Twombly is founder of the multifamily syndication firm Two Bridges Asset Management, LLC, which was founded in 2013, based in Brooklyn, New York. And he's also the founder of the educational community Multifamily Launchpad, which helps people learn everything they need to know to start right in multifamily syndication. He's a graduate of Harvard College and Columbia Law School. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me today.
Oh, my pleasure. My absolute pleasure. I'm really curious. I mean, the same question we ask everybody who comes on is, where'd you start? Where are you now? And how'd you get there? But if you can tell us that with the twist of, I went to Harvard and law school, and now I'm in multifamily syndication, I'd love to hear the story.
Well, I sort of depends on how you look at it. You know, either I was misguided at first or got on the wrong track or, you know, what have you. But I spent 12 years as a corporate lawyer on basically working for like Wall Street law firms, kind of around the world actually, and just really burned out on that after about 3 years, but I did it for 12. I spent the last 9 years trying to figure out what to do with my life. And it wasn't until a combination of things happened. One was that because of the great financial crisis, the work really dried up. The second was I was totally burned out and really wanted to do something else. And I was kind of trying to figure out what the next step was. And the work dried up, I was really interested in real estate anyway. I basically taught myself how to underwrite on the company's dime because I had nothing else to do. So I spent all my time surfing the internet, looking at real estate deals. And in those days I was looking at, you know, like threeplexes and stuff and the Hudson Valley in upstate New York. But by the time it became clear that my firm didn't want to pay me to sit around surfing the internet anymore, I had figured out, it was pretty clear to me what was happening. And I started doing a lot of networking, trying to figure out how I could make my way into the investing business. And to make a long story short, I kind of around the same time, I was told by like a much older guy in real estate in New York, like, forget it. Nobody's ever going to hire you at one of these firms because you're just too senior. And, you know, there's a lot of guys out on the street who are not career changers who have like been doing this for 10 years and they're looking for a job. So like your best shot is if somebody offers to partner with you. And then that literally happened within a few weeks of that conversation where I met somebody through networking who said, hey, I'm starting a real estate investment business. I think you'd be great at raising money. You know, why don't you join me? And lo and behold, I didn't really know what to do, but like how to do due diligence on this offer or on her. So I trotted her around to a bunch of friends to give her pitch and what I was really doing was like trying to get them to tell me what they thought. And what they all thought was, if you decide to do this, I'll give you money to invest. So I thought, you know what, I guess I should try it because I've got the offer of a partnership. I've got the money to invest. And I learned syndication sort of by the seat of my pants that way. But the funny thing was that like, I thought, I just assumed because I live here in New York and like, everybody was all, you know, the fever around like speculating in brownstones and getting ahead of the gentrification, like was such a thing. I just assumed that that was what we were going to do. It wasn't. Went to work with my then partner and she's like, oh no, we're looking at these 100 unit deals in like Louisiana and Texas and stuff. And I was like, 100 units, how are we ever going to come up with the money to buy that? You know, little did I know, it's like cost the same. You could buy in those days, you could buy 100 units for what it cost you to buy a brownstone here in New York. So, you know, that's a little exaggeration. Maybe two brownstones in New York, you could buy, you know, you could get yourself like 6 units here or 100 units in Louisiana. The math has changed a little bit since then, but basically that's what you could do. So that was how I got my start. Sort of fast forward, we kind of banged, you know, our heads against the wall for a while trying to get started doing deals down there. we had all kinds of trouble with lenders. I mean, this is a totally different environment than it is now. I mean, now, like, lenders are throwing money at you. Investors are throwing money at you. This is right after the financial crisis. Everybody was scared. And, you know, we could find deals. And we had the, we actually had the equity lined up from those friends who all said, hey, I'll give you money to invest. But the banks were the problem. And we had the banks actually literally back out of deals at the last minute on us. We were out a lot, you know, never put any investor money at risk, but we personally were out of pocket a lot, you know, a lot of money. And we wound up sort of through that experience realizing that we kind of didn't see eye to eye in a lot of stuff. So we decided to go our own separate ways. One of my investors then said to me, hey, look, I'll back you in a venture if you want to keep on doing this. And I said, sure. So I founded Two Bridges in 2013. And so we're sort of off to the races then.
That's fascinating. I mean, I think a lot of the stories that we hear are the, hey, man, you know, I went out, we decided to form a firm, and it was all, you know, rosy from that point forward. We found our first deal in 9 months, and, you know, we took it down, and we've just been, you know, hitting home runs ever since. I feel like that's a lot of the stories that come across our desk. But it sounds like you had a lot of really trial by fire out of the gate.
It was a different environment. I mean, now, first of all, back in 2013, syndication was still basically like, and people used to call them country club deals, right? They were basically the only way you could get involved in a syndication was if you knew a syndicator and you played golf with them at your country club. And then, you know, you'd tell all your buddies and they'd all get together and they'd, you know, and it was like a little secret, right? It was very hard, like, tapping into those networks if you weren't part of like the country club network or whatever to start. Like I said, I was fortunate. I had friends who wanted to invest, so I had access to some capital. But the way it is now, I mean, now with, like, because of social media, you know, podcasting, forums like Bigger Pockets, Facebook, basically none of that stuff was around, or it was around, but it was just so minor. It was off everybody's radar at the time. And it was very hard to get the word out. So now, you know, people, they come through these programs. It's kind of like almost like a done for you service in some cases. Like, here's, you know, here's your whole media setup. This is what you need to do to build an audience. It's just a completely different world than it was when I started out. So I think it takes a lot less banging your head against the wall now than it did. I mean, you know, also, like, there, it's easy to find people who are going to co-sign in the debt with you, right? Mm-hmm. Like 10 years ago, it was very difficult to find that because everybody was like, oh my God, great financial crisis, foreclosures. I don't want, you know, they're going to come after me. And it was hard to do. Now you've got people, like, I have conversations with new investors and volunteering, like, do you have any, can I sign on the note with you? Like, they want that. So the world has changed a lot, which is why I think you're seeing what you're seeing. The hardest thing for people to do right now is find a deal. And if they can find a deal, it's very easy to get all the other pieces lined up, or much easier than it used to be anyway.
Right, right. What does your business look like now?
Well, now it's in a little bit of a sort of a transition. We're, I sold the entire portfolio that I assembled a couple of years ago. And, you know, I still look for deals. It's just very, very difficult to find deals that make sense. So I'm branching off into other things. I'm looking at cannabis-backed real estate, for example. And, you know, still looking to find deals, but multifamily stuff. But I've been looking at, like, smaller stuff, just trying to find things that are a little off the radar. I've been trying to find, I've been actually changed my markets. You know, I had been focused on the Carolinas because I really like the demographic story down there. But originally I got interested in the Carolinas because they were off the radar. They're not off the radar anymore. You know, everybody was in Texas. Then they discovered the Carolinas, you know, the Southeast, because of the good demographics. My general nature is to be contrarian. So now that everybody is in like the Southeast and the South, you know, and everybody, they're poo-pooing like the Northeast and thinking, well, maybe the Northeast is an interesting place to look because there's just less attention. You know, obviously the laws are a little bit less favorable for landlords and stuff, but it's actually not as bad as it's made out to be. And also depending on where you invest, like New York City obviously is difficult, but if you're in upstate New York, you don't have the same restrictions. So it's, you don't have the great demographics, but the cap rates are better. So I'm looking for, you know, just trying to do what other people are not doing to see if there's opportunity. So those are the things I'm focused on at the moment.
Right, right. I love that. I love the idea of just when everybody goes left, you look right. I think that's always a good move. I'm curious, you sold your portfolio a couple of years ago. What precipitated that move?
Well, it was really just getting an offer I couldn't refuse. I mean, it wasn't just that. It was a couple things that came together at once, but that was like the final thing, getting an offer that I couldn't refuse. But what led up to me being willing to accept the offer was that, you know, I'd invested when I started in a lot of C property. And even, you know, back in 2018, 2019, when the economy was strong, you know, before COVID, we had all kinds of problems with a lot of tenants just collecting rent, right? And I was starting to think about how, man, if we have a recession, if we're having this much trouble getting these tenants to pay, and this wasn't even like, this weren't like slum property. I mean, they were like just solid C market rate properties, right? And not subsidized, not Section 8, not anything, just run-of-the-mill older properties. We just had so much trouble like collecting all the rent we wanted to collect from the tenants in a good economy. I started thinking, well, gosh, what is this going to look like in a bad economy? And there were starting to be some rumblings of like, you know, we might be heading towards a recession now. So I thought I'd rather like read about how people deal with this than deal with it myself. And at the same time, I got really an offer that I thought was way more than I would have asked for. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that presented me the opportunity to like go full circle, close out the deals, you know, create a track record. And that's what I did. So kind of it worked for everybody. Investors are very happy. They did very well, depending on what deal they were in. Some did extraordinarily well. And, you know, that allowed me to kind of put a period on it. And then rather than sort of speculate about what the track record is or tell people, if we sold, this is what they would, you know, our IRRs would be, we could just tell them. So that was really why I did it. But like I said, you know, it's been very difficult to find deals since then. I mean, I noticed really starting about 2016, it started to get to be quite tight in these markets, and it's only gotten worse. And frankly, I mean, I'm really surprised at where we are right now, that it's tighter than ever right now. I never would have predicted that.
Right. No. And it sounds like you you're able to put a period on that, and that, you know, when you're able to make an exit at a price that's above what you would have asked for, then, I mean, it just sounds like a good move. I'm curious, the delinquency, I want to ask you about that. How did you overcome, if you were having delinquency problems, did your buyer just overlook that, or how did you overcome that before you sold it?
I'm not really sure. I'm assuming that their thought was, well, they could do a better job, or that they were planning on doing a value add and just eliminate the problem altogether because they were going to re-tenant. So I'm assuming that was their game plan. And it wasn't on every property. I mean, it was like on a couple of properties. We had a couple of properties that did really well. And even though they were C, like they were in a different market, different submarket, just had better tenants, even though they were at the same level properties. So I think on the ones that were struggling more, they just thought, well, hey, we're going to come in and do a better job than these guys. But I mean, I was convinced that it was really, at least without doing a big major overhaul of those properties, and I wasn't sure the market could sustain it. But short of that, like, we had a very good property management on site. You know, operationally, there wasn't really anything more that we could do. So I think it was just sort of stuck with the tenants we were stuck with. I know one thing that the buyers were planning to do. They were going to self-manage, so they were planning on making some of the spread up that way through self-management. And I know that they were really aggressive in cost cutting. So, but I didn't feel like we had a lot of fat to cut, or else we would have cut it. So I'm not sure what they were cutting, and, you know, what the effect of the cuts were on the properties. But, you know, it's their problem now. So.
Right. Right. That's exactly so, right. You don't have to figure out what their business plan or their exits are, or what their strategy is. It's, hey, you know, you're making me the offer, and okay, I'll take it. Good luck. Good luck. That's interesting. That is very interesting. Talk to us about, what are some of the lessons that you've learned along the way? Maybe some things you did right and some things you did wrong as you went from, you know, no properties to scaling and then selling.
I would say that it's really, one of the adages that you never hear anymore, but people used to say all the time when I started, was you make money when you buy the property. That's when you make your money. If you don't buy it right, too bad, right? It's, you're never going to catch up. And that turned out to be absolutely true in practice for me. Mm. You know, I feel like on the deals that didn't do well, even though sort of objectively, if you looked at sort of like the price per door or the cap rate that we bought them at, people would, you know, you would say, oh, you bought it right. But we overpaid for those properties. It was clear that we overpaid. And we, you know, once we got into the operations and we just saw sort of how things worked out. And I know, for instance, and then on the ones that did well, we got good deals. Like, you know, we got, I think one of them we stole. We didn't realize, I didn't realize I was stealing it when I bought it. I thought I was worried I was overpaying for it, but it turned out that I stole it. But it all came down to that. The other thing I would say is that, like, I thought I knew how to underwrite when I started, but I really didn't. And I think because a lot of what, maybe things are different. Hopefully they're different now. And certainly I teach things differently than the way that I was taught. And hopefully, you know, the other people out there teaching how to underwrite are also doing the same thing. But I know that, you know, when I started, you know, I took the seller's numbers and I used them to underwrite on and thought and made my offer accordingly and thought I was getting a good deal because I got it at the cap rate that I wanted. Turned out that the seller's cost structure was not my cost structure at all. And because of various things, there were, you know, taxes, property taxes went up, you know, my labor costs were higher, my management fees were more, my insurance costs were way higher. You know, there was a whole bunch of things that, you know, if you just listen to, like, we'll use the actuals, underwrite in actuals, that's wrong advice, doesn't apply to you. So you have to understand really, like, which actuals to use or what your actuals are, right? And that's really critical. Problem is, I mean, it's not really a problem, but it's frustrating, you know, using that metric now when I underwrite, just very, very hard to find deals that pencil out, right? So makes it hard to buy deals, to be honest. And, you know, I'm seeing some time I underwrite deals not close to where they are selling for, because I just don't see how the people who are buying are making the numbers work. So maybe I'm the dummy. I don't know, but it's, you know, like it's when you're trying to build in a margin of safety, it becomes very difficult.
How would you recommend someone figure out what their numbers are as compared to what the seller's numbers are?
Yeah, well, one of the best ways to do that is to cheat. And when I say to cheat, what I mean is, when I underwrite deals now, what I do every time is I take them to my management company and I also take them to my lender. And I say, because I notice that they will both underwrite the deals, right? So I will, maybe to the management company, I might not ask them to underwrite it. I'll ask them questions about, like, what's the labor cost going to be on this property? What's the, you know, stuff like that. I want to find out those numbers. How much is it going to cost you to operate a unit, right, in this market and this kind of deal? I want to know that because I want to check on my own underwriting. The lenders also are great. If you have a mortgage broker that you work with, you know, they have metrics that they apply when they're underwriting deals, you know, for Fannie and Freddie and stuff. And they're seeing tons and tons of deals and they really understand the cost structure. So I also find it really reassuring when I get their underwriting back and it's around where mine is, right? So on the expense side, that's something that you can do to make sure that you're not, you know, underestimating the expenses on the property. And that's really the critical thing. Like rents, you know, rents you can move up, right? You may not move them up as much as you want to, but you can move up rents. Expenses are very hard to do anything about, right? They sort of are what they are. Can't do anything about utilities, you know, after you've done like whatever kind of, you know, concert, you know what I mean? Like you can change out all the light bulbs and you can do that stuff, but that's not going to save you that much money. You know, you can institute RUBS or whatever, but there's not a whole lot you can do to change it. You can't change your insurance costs unless you get big enough to start bidding it out, right? And, you know, and that's, you've got to have $50 million or more of insurable property before you start getting a break on your insurance. Property taxes, you can't do anything about. Labor costs, you know, that's always a, you can skimp on the staff at the property, but it's going to come back to bite you. So there's not really a lot you can do on the cost side in a lot of cases. You have to focus on the revenue side. But if you mess up the cost side in your underwriting, you're going to overpay, and then it's going to be a struggle.
Yeah, I think that's really, really sound advice that, you know, we don't hear that often, which is to, like you said, compare your seller's costs to what you know that your costs should or could be. So that's absolutely fascinating. Jonathan, we are running out of time here.
All right.
So let's jump into the final four if we can. Here's the final four questions. The first one is, what is one piece of advice that you would give to an aspiring investor?
Well, I'm going to reiterate what I said, which is learn how to underwrite. Really learn how to underwrite. That's a skill that is just going to really help you.
Right. That's great. What is one thing you are currently doing to stay on top of your game?
I try to look at deals. I mean, just keep on looking at deals and do a lot of networking. So those two things, keep the deals coming, keep the money coming. It's kind of what you got to keep focused on.
When it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you are making the world a better place?
I try to raise my kids to be better than I was.
That's a high bar. So that's good. That's good for you. John, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
So there are a number of ways that you can get in touch, but one really easy way is to join my Facebook group, which is called Multifamily Investment Community. It is about 11,000 members currently, and it's a no spam, no BS, just networking and good advice group. So please join that. That's a way to get to know me. And then there are other ways to get in touch once you're in that group.
Right. That's awesome. Jonathan, thanks so much for your time today. I certainly appreciate it.
You're absolutely welcome. Thank you for having me on the show.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.